case. And now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 8. And I am now here with Jared Taylor. Jared, thank you for coming back on Millennial. You and Greg Johnson are the only two people who have been on it every single year since 2015. So I'm glad to continue that tradition. And all right.
Well, it's been a real baton death march, hasn't it? I wish you many, many more millennials. This is a wonderful tradition. I'm delighted you started it, and I didn't realize I shared that honor only with Greg Johnson. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, it's a thing, and people come and go, you know, but there are people who remain consistent and who I don't fall out with, so they're on every year. So it's nice. So not that I go out of my way to fall out with people, quite the reverse. I think everyone knows who you are. Everyone who's watching my channel will be familiar with you. But do you want to introduce Amren to people just in case, just for the sake of it?
Oh, certainly. I never assume anyone has heard of me. My name is Jared Taylor, and I'm the editor of American Renaissance, which once upon a time was a print magazine. And it started in 1990. And went through the mails until 2012. And it's in that year that we switched everything over to the internet and became modern 21st century people. And of course, the internet has expanded our reach very, very considerably. As a print publication, we never had more than 3,000 or 4,000 subscribers. And now sometimes we get as many as 1 million different people around the world in a month. So that's been a huge, huge, huge boost up. Our approach is what we call race realism and white advocacy. Race realism, recognizing that race is a biological phenomenon and the different races do not create the same societies worldwide. And white advocacy has to do with the fact that whites, just like every other group, have their own legitimate interests that must be promoted. So that, in a nutshell, is myself.
Excellent. What would you say about the propensity of white people to see that they have group interests? Because this seems to be, in my opinion, this is the main problem, is that they don't even recognize that they do, that they are a group, and that that group matters, and that it has interests. And what would you say about that?
You're absolutely right. Sam Francis, who was a great friend of mine and whom Patrick Buchanan called the Clausewitz of the right, and really was one of the seminal original thinkers of white identitarian politics, died in 2005, I guess. Gosh, it's been a long time now. He said, whites exist objectively, but they don't exist subjectively. And by that, he meant other people are aware of us. And other people treat us as a distinct group. But we ourselves, for the most part, are not aware of ourselves as a distinct group. And this is a real change from the way whites used to think about themselves. Up until, I would say, about the 1950s, in the United States at least, everyone assumed that this was a nation that was built for white people. There were blacks, there were American Indians here, but they were kind of an afterthought. And I'm sure in the 1950s, Britain also, it considered itself a wholly European country. And the idea that London would become a metropolis in which whites were to become a minority, that would have just flabbergasted anyone. But no, it is this terrible problem that whites have to consider themselves as individuals and not as a group, not as part of this wonderful subspecies of Homo sapiens that developed Western civilization, and without which I'm convinced Western civilization cannot continue. It is this atomization of whites that really is, I think, one of the most mysterious phenomena of the last 60, 70 years.
I know that, Ricardo Duchesne did a fantastic stream on Millennial a few nights ago where he talked about how Western civilization depends on white people. It depends on our surviving in order to continue it. Also, I know that Kevin MacDonald has just recently, in the last few years, published a new book about this and about it, because it seems to go back to individualism. It seems to go back to our insistence on the I don't know what you would say, the sovereignty, the grandeur of the individual. And of course, that's our strength. Of course it is. We don't believe that the tall nail should be hammered down. We don't believe that everyone should conform. We don't believe that there should be terrible stringent standards, and et cetera. We definitely believe in freedom. And the grandeur of the individual doesn't quite cover it. It's the beauty of the individual. But unfortunately, it also becomes a terrible weakness.
Yes, we are the victims of our own virtues in a way. I do believe that it is the individualism of Western man that has created our wonderful civilization. The Chinese are on average probably smarter than we are, but they do not have the creative genius. They do not have this Faustian spirit. Back in the 1450s, they had seagoing vessels that were five times the size of the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria that Columbus sailed to the United States in. And they sailed around Africa, and they took a look at it, and they decided, well, we've got everything we want. We're just going to stay home. That was not the European way. We always wanted to go further, climb higher, swim deeper. There's something, I think, remarkably romantic, remarkably cosmos-oriented about white people. And so, and it takes individuals to do that. I think that the East Asians, perhaps given the circumstances under which they evolved, they became more conformist, and they developed this average high IQ, but they just don't have the genius outliers that our people have. But why is it that, after all, there was a time when white people did think of themselves as a group? If you look at the history of colonization, that really was a period of literal white supremacy. We're being accused of white supremacy all the time, simply if we don't loathe ourselves. But when the French were in Africa, they had what they called the mission civilisatrice. This was a civilizing mission. And it was not a joke to talk about the white man's burden. And all of that just crumbled. It crumbled over a period of some decades. But it's not as though we never had a sense of being in it together, a sense of solidarity. And even now, when whites are confronted by a mutual challenge, well, for example, I remember spending about 12 months just vagabonding around West Africa. And every white person who was traveling would be drawn almost magnetically to any other white person. Here you're surrounded by Africans, people who are aliens, and you'd see a white person waiting at a bus stop or waiting to get on a boat, and you would just sidle up to each other. There was a commonality there that we simply didn't have with the Africans who were the obvious majority. This is not completely gone from white people. There is a sort of still this lingering instinctive sense that we are brothers under the skin, but the inability of whites to recognize that if they do not unite in some kind of common purpose, they'll be shoved aside by people with much sharper elbows and a much more highly developed sense of their interests that must be pushed, must be promoted at our expense. And in fact, I would say that whites do have an identity, and increasingly it's one that's been given to us by our rulers and by people who oppose us, and it's a strictly negative identity. In the United States, we're all supposed to be enjoying unearned white privilege. And that explains every failure by non-whites. If Mexicans or Haitians or Guatemalans don't do as well as whites in the United States, it's because we are even unconsciously just grinding them down. We've got our boot in their face. this utterly negative and horrifying identity that we had, as opposed to the one we used to have. In the United States, we built monuments to our heroes, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson. Now they're all considered great criminals. That the United States history is nothing but a crime scene. This has been a remarkable and, I think, utterly unprecedented reversal in any kind of experience of a people.
Would you say that 2020 was a turning point in terms of things getting much worse? Because it seems to me that, a quantum leap kind of thing.
Yes, yes. As I say, I've had my fingers on the pulse of American racial consciousness now for more than 30 years. I hardly imagine that much time has gone by. And there has been a gradual deterioration. But May 25th, 2020, I can put an exact date on it. That was when George Floyd, the now sanctified George Floyd, died under the knee of this poor white cop, Derek Chauvin. And the madness that set off, that is something that I would never have anticipated. And what actually happened that day in Minneapolis was not such an outlandish or outrageous thing, which suggests to me that the madness of the Black Lives Matter could have been touched off by practically anything. And the great change that it worked in the minds of at least a certain number of whites is to convince them somehow that each white person is somehow individually responsible, personally responsible for the failures of non-whites. This is something that was never felt or expressed as vividly as it was at that time. And I may have made this point to you before, but back in the 1960s race riots, no one would have thought that the appropriate reaction to Black grievance was to, for heaven's sake, tear down statues of Christopher Columbus. And yet, during this terrible series of riots, no fewer than 30 statues of Columbus all around different places in the country were either torn down by mobs or taken down by the city authorities for fear that their darling pets might be injured, pulling them down on top of themselves. But this is to suggest that the entire project of America as an extension of Western civilization was illegitimate, that it was a crime to begin with. This is a new and horrifying perspective on the United States that it did surprise me, but at the same time, I believe that what if I'm allowed to quote Dickens? I suppose as a native speaker of English, I am. These are the worst of times, but they're also the best of times, because as the left overplays its hand, as it is egregiously doing, I see signs of white people realizing what is at stake.
Well, I thought you were going to go into that. Is that something that you think has been galvanized by the events of 2020? Because I would think it has been. I think that everything that happens seems to drive, it seems to red pill a few more people.
Yes. There has been, at this stage in the development of white racial consciousness, it's still defensive. It is not on the offense. White people are reacting to outrages that no one could have imagined a decade or even half a decade ago. Critical race theory was this completely cuckoo idea that white people are inherently racist, that we have this flaw that we're born with, and that instinctively, without even thinking about it, without even being conscious of it, we, with every breath, we oppress non-whites. And that's not an exaggeration what they think. White silence is violence. We are oppressing people even in our sleep. I suppose even in the silence of the grave, Robert E. Lee is oppressing, he's committing violence against white people through his white silence. This kind of utter foolishness, this used to be bottled up like it was some sort of radioactive poison on college campuses, but this is now percolating into grade schools and into churches. And when you really do make little Johnny, your 9-year-old white boy in the suburbs, get up in front of class and list all the ways in which he enjoys unfair privilege, well, mommy does not like that. And there has been a very powerful reaction against this. And at first, it started off being denounced as something that was divisive. But now people are prepared to say, this is anti-white. This is anti-white, and we're not standing for it. Also, there has been a grudging acceptance in certain circles that the Great Replacement is happening. At first, whenever this would come up, people, oh no, this is a conspiracy theory. Nothing like this is happening. Of course, at the same time, the very people who would condemn someone like me and call me a paranoid conspiracy theorist for talking about the replacement of whites, then quietly they would celebrate the changes that they can anticipate politically when there are more Hispanics, when there are more Chinese. They would anticipate quite explicitly that the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms in the United States, will glimmer away as the population changes and becomes more non-white. So on the one hand, it's a great thing when they notice it and it's moving in the direction they like. If someone like me says, the country's changing in ways we never asked for and we don't like, then it's a conspiracy theory and it's not happening. Well, the idea that demographic change is taking place and some people don't care for it. This is something that is being talked about in a somewhat more realistic way. Likewise, differences in crime rates. This is something that just can't be shoved under the carpet anymore. And the Black Lives Matter movement and all of this vilification of the police. And I'm sure you're aware of what's called the Ferguson effect. That was from Ferguson, Missouri, when they had riots there over the shooting of the perfectly legitimate shooting of a Black criminal. All of this criticism of the police means that the police are not going to risk their job, risk their careers, in some cases risk their lives, policing in the kind of aggressive, active way that's necessary to keep Blacks from shooting each other. And so when the police disappear, the Blacks start shooting each other very, very briskly in 2020 to 2021. The murder rate in the United States went up by 30%, the largest jump in the history of record keeping. And so at least a few people are beginning to recognize that, there's some things are going on. Maybe firing all the police officers is not the best thing. There are changes. And at the same time, there are many different organizations, certainly in the U.S., and I suspect increasingly in Europe as well, of wide-awake white people who are not noticed by the media, and for that reason, not persecuted, but who are communicating with each other, starting websites, starting groups, and also starting communities of people who are building families, really seceding from the current sick culture and trying to establish entities and communities of their own. This is not the sort of thing that the other side has cottoned to, and people are much more careful about doing things that are explicitly pro-white because they realize what the price is that can be paid. So I'm optimistic that things are moving, and I believe that our people have always risen to the occasion. Of course, this is a particularly difficult challenge because it's not like the Spartans facing the Persians at Thermopylae. They knew there's the enemy. The enemy is right there, and you kill as many as you can or die trying. It's much, much more difficult. We face a crisis that is, I think, potentially more fatal than our race has ever faced in the past. But it's so much more difficult because the people on the opposing side, so many of them are brothers and sisters, liberals in positions of power who have a tremendous amount to lose from the kind of world that they appear to be preparing to build for themselves and their children, their grandchildren. And so we have this terrible problem of being in a psychological civil war with our own people in an attempt to save them from themselves. But in a way, it makes it a wonderful time to be alive. I think it is a tremendous challenge. And for those of us who understand what is at stake, there could be no more thrilling undertaking or project than to be working for the survival and for the ultimate progress and future glory of this great people of which we are a part.
That's a lovely sentiment. And I do agree that it is something worth fighting for. It is something that's a galvanizing thing.
There's nothing, I believe there's nothing more worth fighting for. I mean, even beyond the sacrifices we make for our own children, for example, for one's family to be wiped out, that's a terrible thing. But to imagine the biological basis of one's entire culture to be wiped out, that there's nothing more worth, nothing better worth fighting for, I believe.
Oh, certainly. And this is what makes it so amazing that a lot of white people don't see this, you know, because, and indeed, you know, a lot of, you know, we're talking about liberals. it's almost a dirty word now, and maybe the way I say it betrays how I feel about it all now.
Yes.
And I used to be one, and I have some natural sympathy for them, and yet I feel very much apart from them now. And very exasperated with them, because to me, everything that they value depends on the thing that they seem intent on destroying. And of course, they would deny that they're going to destroy the white race, but everything that they, all the policies they advocate lead to that. So exactly. There isn't going to be the sort of artsy little cafe or the art house cinema or whatever, you know, liberals value. This stuff absolutely depends on us. To say nothing of the material, the films, the artworks and so on that would be shown in those places. Again, it springs from us. If you value those things, you have to value the creature that made them and the gene pool that made it all possible.
Well, the fact is, I was once a liberal too. A fairly enthusiastic liberal.
That's a hell of an admission.
Oh, I was. I was. And in fact, I think in a way it makes me a better white man. It makes me, I believe, more generous to the people that many on our side consider our sworn enemies. So many people think that progressive whites are evil, bad people, that they're consciously doing their own race it right down into the dirt, into the ground. I know that they don't feel that way. I was not a bad person when I was a liberal and suddenly became a good person when I ceased being a liberal. And I will tell you that in certain respects, being a liberal has a kind of thrill to it. And the thrill, I think, is an almost exclusively Caucasian thrill. And that is the thrill of being morally superior to one's political opponents. One of the great attractions of progressivism or liberalism or white insanity or whatever it is you want to call it, is the idea that people like you and me are not merely wrong, but we are evil. They're convinced of this. And there is such joy in thinking that you are the moral superior of your opponent. I don't know if I've spoken about this in previous installations of Millennial, but there's a wonderful book called Pathological Altruism. And one of the many remarkable things that I learned from that book was that the sense of moral superiority stimulates the same parts of the brain as narcotic drugs. And people become addicted to this sense of moral superiority. And I am convinced that when so many of those who oppose us denounce us as threats to democracy or simply evil or oppressors. And it goes all the way back to Susan Sontag in 1963, I believe it was, describing what the white race is, the cancer of human history. This idea of feeling superior to all that is something they can't resist. And I think, again, this is something that's unique to white people. This great love of feeling morally superior. Now, other races can become fanatical. A Muslim jihadi, for example, he will go into the fight with the same kind of scimitar-slashing madness that your wokist goes into battling against white supremacy, whatever it is he thinks he's battling. But for them, it's different. They're defending their own interests. They're going into battle. It's like the Spartans against the Persians. They are fighting the enemy, whereas for white people, these morally superior white people, it's fighting against their own tribe. There's something, and there's no fun for a white person in feeling morally superior to blacks or to Hispanics. What's the good of that?
Yeah, that's no contest.
Implicitly
acknowledges something.
But if you can be morally superior to tall, blonde, handsome Nazis, wow, you got to be flying high to be better than those people. And I think you could define white people as a particularly excitable subspecies of Homo sapiens whose basal ganglia, that's the part of the brain that's stimulated by narcotics, are particularly susceptible to psychological stimulation. It's one of our abiding traits, this notion of being morally superior. I was particularly taken by this. I was reading about the abolitionists, and not just the American abolitionists, but some of the British abolitionists too. They had exactly the same mentality that the worst sociology professors and hopped up preachers and all of this moral preening, they had exactly the same thing. In fact, William Lloyd Garrison, he's perhaps our most famous abolitionist newspaper writer, editor. As it turns out, if you look closely into his behavior, he didn't really care much about black people. In fact, he swindled black people to get money for various projects that he was interested in carrying out. But when it came to the moral superiority of the abolitionist against slaveholders, that's where they got their real thrill. Many abolitionists, they were perfectly prepared to, they didn't like slavery and they didn't like slaveholders, but they wanted to, once the slaves were free, they wanted to ship them back to Africa. That was often combined with abolition. Abolition combined with what they called colonization. But the idea of being morally superior to slaveholders, another one of our abolitionists, her name was Angelina Grimke. And she was once asked, she was going on about the absolute horrors of slavery. And someone, a skeptic in the audience, asked her, aren't you exaggerating a little bit? Are these white people really so bloodthirsty and perverted and degenerate as you say? She says, there can be no exaggeration. Imagination cannot go further than the facts. This sort of idea that they are fighting outright evil, this is something that white people have had for some time. You go back to the French Revolution. Remember, Diderot said that there will be no justice until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. You could almost say that in the United States today, the really hopped up types would say that there will never be true justice until the last white man is strangled to the entrails of the last white woman. We are the problem.
It's amazing. I mean, I'm laughing not because I realize that this is very serious, but yes, the absurdity of believing yes. this stuff. And especially when there is the evidence of, I don't know how to say this delicately, when there is the evidence of how other peoples live and the evidence of the cultures that are produced by the people that you're now trying to flood the West with. I just don't understand how they can rationalize this, except that to say that they are, it's not based on rationality. It's something that they love this. They enjoy this. And so the facts don't matter.
It is a mysterious thing. And sometimes it seems to me that our interest in facts, in science, in logic, in fair-mindedness is almost a disadvantage. It's when people believe in the impossible, when they're in a fight against human nature itself, this seems to drive a certain personality. And after all, let's be clear about this. Progressivism is really a fight against human nature. It's the idea that men can become women, and the fatness can be beautiful, that black people can become white people, that we can live from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. All of this utter craziness if you are building a project that requires you to transform human nature in impossible ways, your job is never done. Your funding is never enough. You get the bit between your teeth until you die. There is this utter outlandishness of what they're up to. Whereas we will say, well, wait, you know, there's a certain consistent pattern to the societies that Black people build. And there are certain consistent patterns societies white people build. And same things for East Asians. Could this possibly be inherent? No. They've got to come up with some cuckoo explanation to fit every single disparate part into their one utterly nutty theory about human nature. But I do try to cast my mind back to the time when I believed all this liberal baloney. I suppose you've tried that too. Of course, you were probably not liberal for as long as I was. I suppose I should be embarrassed to confess that I was pretty much a liberal until I was maybe in my early 30s. That's a long time of believing stuff that is preposterous and untrue. But those people, they really do think that they are building a better world. And that's why our fight is so tragic, that we have these people opposed to us who are really our brothers and sisters, who think that we're evil, but we have to embrace them not as our sworn enemies, but as our wayward sisters and wayward brothers. That makes our fight so much more difficult.
Yeah. I certainly wasn't still a liberal in my early 30s, but I mean, I think it's interesting that you took that path. And of course, there also wasn't certain avenues by which you could learn about certain topics at that time. I mean, there are people who are very red-pilled by, you know, their mid-teens nowadays, which is astonishing.
Yes, it's remarkable. I agree.
Yeah. For me, it was from the age of 19, but that was when I first realized multiculturalism doesn't work. And then it was one issue after another, but I can't really remember the order of the issues. Race, I think, was more like mid or late 20s. I think I suspected from my mid 20s, and definitely by my late 20s, I was pretty damn sure that it was a real thing and it mattered, and that certain races were different and all that kind of thing. But, yeah, you know, I guess from your point of view, having been a liberal until your early 30s would probably make it easier for you to remember what it's like and what the habits of thought are, the habits of thinking, and therefore to empathize with them. I mean, whereas for me, they're a bit of a mystery.
Yes. And I'm always being berated by people who came to a correct understanding of all of these phenomena earlier than I for my naivete. But I think they're wrong. In a discussion of Angela Merkel, for example, there are people who say, well, she must hate Germany. When she admitted 1,500,000 of these utter aliens, religiously, culturally, racially, linguistically, utter aliens into her country. How could she have done that unless she despised Germany and the people who are Germans? Well, she didn't have to do that. I believe she probably sincerely believed that these were people in distress, and Germany is a rich nation. Germany can afford to help these people. That this is a way of doing good for people who deserve some kind of helping hand. She probably also thought that, well, the birth rate in Germany is low. These people will come to our country, they will become good Germans, and they will pay our retirement checks. At the same time, she must have known, and this did end up happening, she became Person of the Year, cover of Time magazine. The media would fawn over her, pat her, cuddle her, and she would be a hero to all the people who are the psychological and intellectual trendsetters of the world. All of this, to me, is a far more plausible explanation than the idea that somehow she has a vicious contempt and hatred for her own people and wants them all to die. Whereas that is a tempting explanation in the minds of many people who think the way you and I do. Now, It's true. If she was viciously anti-German and she wanted all those people to die, but wasn't prepared to pull the trigger, what she did was a good way of bringing it about. And so it is easy to see the act and see its consequences and impute motive. But I believe if we impute evil motives, it makes it much, much more difficult for us to persuade those people to come over to our side. It is impossible to have a serious conversation with someone who is convinced that you think every one of their motives is evil. But that's a very difficult thing for people who have maybe never been a liberal, or they were liberals so long ago they forgot what it feels like, to recognize that those people are well-meaning. They are not trying to snuff out the creators of Western civilization. They don't see in those terms at all. They think they are on the side of the angels, that they are helping build a better world. They genuinely think that. Now, when I say that to many of my friends and comrades, they just laugh at me. No, no. Well, I've been one of those people. I've been related to people like that. I still have relatives and some people I'd call my friends who think in those terms. And so we must not impute evil motives to others. Perhaps I'm particularly sensitive to that because evil motives are always being imputed to us. We're always called hate mongers. Well, we're not hate mongers. We just don't happen to hate ourselves the way we're supposed to be good white people. So I think it's important to realize that, first of all, for our views to have any effect on the real world, more people have to share them. And the only way to share them is to get people who disagree with us now to agree with us. We have to change their minds. And we believe that we are clearly right and they are wrong, but they are not evil. And they have to be approached as I said before, our wayward brethren rather than our sworn enemies.
Indeed. What you say about Angela Merkel is interesting. I think you're right. I think she's a sort of machine woman. I don't think she has much emotion. And other people, many people have said this about her. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right that she is looking to create a better world as she sees it. Mm-hmm. And the premise, one of the key sort of axioms for her is racial equality. Therefore, it's possible for her to believe that bringing in a million Africans will be of benefit to the economy and they'll pay for the pensions, as you said. Of course, once you don't believe in racial equality, that notion immediately seems absurd and ridiculous. But of course, you know, all sorts of ridiculous things are possible if you believe in racial equality. Just let me give you one other example. There was a judge in Sweden who, and I know that Sweden comes in for a lot of mockery, and I don't mean it that way because I care about Sweden. I don't want to see it destroyed or whatever. But a few years ago, there was a judge, and I think it was a Somalian, had raped a Swedish woman. And the judge had the choice of whether to deport this Somalian or not. And then he gave his reasoning, I guess, in some sort of interview or a statement to the press. He said, we mustn't deport this Somalian because in Somalia, he's likely to rape Somalian women. Their methods of policing and so on are not as efficient as ours. So if we deport him to Somalia, knowing that he's likely to deport Somalian women, then we're saying that Somalian women aren't worth as much, aren't as important as Swedish women. We're saying that we value Swedish women over Somalian women. Now that is, I mean, you want to wring the guy's neck.
Yes, it's
enraging. What would you say about this?
This is a uniquely white disease. No non-white person would ever even conceive of such a thing, much less say it. Now, I haven't heard about that particular case, but it doesn't surprise me. It reminds me of the reactions that have been common among liberals about the uncomplaining way in which Europeans have accepted Ukrainian refugees. When they first started coming in, there was all of this harumphing. Well, wait a minute. you guys sure didn't accept Muslims and Africans, and you're still trying to keep people from crossing the Mediterranean and landing in Greece and Italy. How dare you? And no one, as far as I could say, is, well, of course we care about these people. They're white. They're European. They're Christian. Of course we care about them more than those aliens with whom we have nothing in common. No one dared say this. That's our problem. But that, to me, shows that the instincts are still there. White people, at some deep level, understand that race is profoundly important. And I sometimes taunt liberals, I think in a friendly way. I say, you just need to get in touch with your feelings. That was the sort of hippie admonition of the 1960s or 1970s. You need to get in touch with your feelings, because where is it that they decide to live? Where do they send their children to school? Whom do they invite to their dinner parties? The idea that everybody's the same and we're all multicultural, we hold hands and sing kumbaya, nobody does that. In their own lives, they don't do that. So get in touch with your feelings and bring your feelings up into that forebrain, and then start acting consciously in a way that is in accordance with your feelings. And these are the feelings that I described earlier when people are traveling in Africa and they just make a beeline, white people, for each other. And they make this little white community traveling together in this sea of blackness. And it's the same way they welcomed these refugees from Ukraine. Of course, there is a slight difference. The people come from Ukraine were almost women and almost all women and children. Much easier to bring in and to welcome, and they are not the kind of a threat that all these young Muslim men were going to be. But the main thing is that these were our kinfolk. And there was an instinctive opening of the hearts and the wallets and homes for these people, because they were us in a way that Muslims and Africans cannot be.
Oh, absolutely. And you certainly don't need to persuade me of that.
No.
I'm not going to disagree. You know.
The point I'm making, though, is that when in so many ways, white people still have these healthy inclinations, but they have somehow bought into the utterly suicidal formulations that they've been taught so many times to repeat, that it's like they've emasculated their own brains. They can't get aside. They can't get out of this way of thinking that they've been taught over and over again.
Oh, indeed. I saw somebody talk, that there was a thing that was shared today about Cheddar Man and how liberals will always, and this has been a real victory in Britain for the race blindness, you know, the Cheddar Man thing, because even though it's been debunked, it doesn't matter. The debunking wasn't registered by most of the population, or at least most of the Twitterati. So they can continue to use this fallacious nonsense to undermine the idea that there even is a British people.
Do they still trot out Cheddar Man? And there's a mock-up. He looked like, I don't know.
I'll show you. I've got this thing from just today. I saw this. I think it's from today. Here it is. It's like a computer game of never-ending zombies marching at you. No matter how many times you defeat them, they just keep respawning. And so it's three of them here. One of them just says, I'm just going to leave this here for the English DNA expert, basically to say that there's no such thing as English DNA because of Cheddar Man. Yeah. Then this one mentions the Roman auxiliary, which again was dealt with by Survive the Jive the other night. It's just this one guy. and then the third person says, also, where does one draw the line? Keep digging into one's genetics enough, and then we're all Africans. Such a pointless argument. By pointless, I mean racist. Yeah. So what would you say to those arguments, just for the sake of it?
In the case of Cheddar Man, this was based on analysis of ancient DNA, was it not? And the original theory was that the DNA that they discovered in this, 8,000 years old, I can't remember exactly, Cheddar Man, that this, gosh, according to his DNA, he was producing melanin lickety-split just like people living in Africa. He was just black as tar. And then later on, the further, more level-headed analysis determined that that wasn't true at all. There's no reason to conclude that. But the delight with which the establishment leapt upon this idea is just part of the astonishing self-loathing that some whites have conceived for themselves. Again, this is something that I cannot imagine. I cannot imagine in any other people. The idea that diversity is somehow a great thing. I mean, he went to the Chinese and said, you know, not a bad country you got here, you know, but too damn many Chinese. You know, you need some, I don't know, you need Swahili speakers. You need Guatemalans. They'd send you to the psych ward. But this is the kind of thing that white people have taught themselves to say. And despite the fact that I have been observing this phenomenon for more than 30 years, and you hinted at this at the beginning of this conversation, this to me is a great mystery. Where does it come from? Where does it come from? And it's all very well to talk about our basal ganglia being particularly susceptible to psychological stimulation. That's not a good answer. I don't know where it comes from. And as I say, this is something that has been a transformation that took place only within the last century, surely. White people have become denatured and prepared to find some kind of virtue in giving away their own countries. What people ever did that? This is historically without precedent. No people has ever done this. There's something deeply wrong about us, and it's something we're going to have to fix, or there won't be any of us left.
Absolutely. Okay, there are quite a few questions, so we should get to those now.
Right.
Okay, one person wants you to say something because I think he would find it amusing in your accent. I think that's perhaps lowering the tone somewhat. We'll pass over that one.
I'll entertain him anyway. I will quote from Herman Melville, and I will repeat Captain Ahab's question. Hast seen the white whale?
Okay. All right. Yes. Universum says, my question for Uncle Jared is, that's the affectionate name by which you are known in these circles. My question for Uncle Jared is, have your views... I don't want to ask that question. I think it's a bit too involved. Sorry, Universum, but I think you'll understand. Okay, Jay says, I still love you, Mr. T. Eternal Anglo said, thank you, gentlemen, for your service to our race. And then there were a number of them on Odyssey, so I'll just get to that now. Caesar himself said, long live Uncle Jared.
Caesar.
Caesar himself. Caesar. Yeah. Irish Nationalist Media said, Jared Taylor and Amren set the standards for professionalism and optics and are leading examples in the European nationalist identity movement.
Oh, your listeners, your viewers are too kind. They are far too kind. We're just doing our part. Yes. But thank you very much. Thank you very much.
He goes on. The way Jared Taylor speaks and presents his arguments must be studied and thought to our activists and taught to our activists and supporters. Jared Taylor speaking can be shown to almost anyone. And I think that's true. Other people have said that in the past.
Well, the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes. Maximus gives $5. Thank you for that. K-Max says, that's about a different matter. I think that's from the previous stream. That's fine. Skugolf, thank you for that. 2.5 credits. And then some random bloke says, I learned through Steve Saylor of the world's most important graph, 4.5 billion Africans in Africa alone by 2100. I have not heard anyone else talk about this statistic. Even Colonel Gaddafi warned of Europe turning black. Does Jared think Europe's future is Camp of the Saints?
Europe's future depends on whether or not Europe has any backbone. It depends on whether Europeans are prepared to say, no, this nation, this culture, this continent was built for us, not for you. And that is something that white people seem almost preternaturally incapable of saying. I agree that this tremendous population explosion we're seeing in Africa is one of the most important phenomena in the future. And eventually, my recollection is that by the end of this century, there could be more Africans than Asians. The Asians are not reproducing themselves. Africans, on the other hand, are reproducing themselves like rabbits. But occasionally, this crops up in public discourse. Emmanuel Macron, of all people, once said something in an offhand way about this looming population bomb in Africa. And he talked about it in a way that suggested that he understood it and he saw it as a threat to Europe. I believe Bill Gates, whom many people love to hate, he has worried about the population explosion in Africa. But it's something that we daren't talk about in any serious way. But that's 100% correct. My recollection is that in the 1950s, there were twice as many white people as there were Africans. There are twice as many Africans as there are Europeans. And pretty soon, those curves just go way out of sight as our numbers decline and theirs go through the roof. And of course, so many of those Africans will not be content to stay in Africa because they have made a wreck of their own marvelous and wonderfully resourced continent. What we see in South Africa, of course, is a sign of things that will come our way if we let those people come our way.
Indeed. Okay, some random bloke also asks, what does Jared think of Kevin MacDonald?
I think Kevin MacDonald is a great scholar, and I think that the role that Jews play in Gentile societies is something that is extremely important and very much worthy of study. I have a great deal of respect for Kevin MacDonald.
Okay, excellent. And some random bloke also asked, what does Jared think of John Derbyshire's thought bubble of the White-Yellow Alliance? I.e. high IQ whites and Northeast Asians forming an alliance due to similar problems, i.e. declining birth rates.
Well, I think if we are ever to be replaced, I would rather be replaced by East Asians rather than anyone else. We and they are the high IQ races. And even if we are all gone, at least the Japanese will continue to play Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. But that's not good enough. I want our people to be playing Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. To me, the idea of an alliance based on falling birth rates, for example, I'm not sure that that is enough. We can respect the Asians. We can, in fact, respect any group that is trying to develop its own culture, trying to be the best nation, the best culture it can possibly be, so long as it does not encroach on ours. My view of the Asians in that respect is no different from my view of the Africans. I want black people to be the best possible black people they can be. And I believe that they can be the best possible black people they can be only when they are moving under their own steam, when they take responsibility for their own lives. In that respect, I don't see Asians as any different from Africans. I want black people to build Wakanda if they're able to build Wakanda. And they're never going to get anywhere by living in our societies and blaming us for their failures. They've got to grow up. They've got to realize that they sink and swim entirely because of their own abilities. One of the terrible things we've done to blacks is to convince them, certainly in the United States, and I'm sure it's the case in Britain as well, that everything that's gone wrong for them is our fault. And in a way, that's the best possible way of saying, don't even lift a muscle because whitey's going to get you one way or the other. No. They have got to realize that their destiny is in their hands and they can be truly African only when they are living amongst themselves in their own homelands where they are responsible for what they do, not us.
Yeah, indeed. And it would be a far more dignified thing as well.
Dignified. That's an excellent word. That's an excellent choice of word. All this whining we hear from them, you'd think they'd get sick of their own voices, all of this complaining. As you say, be a man. Take some responsibility. Good grief. It's embarrassing.
Yeah. Okay, Rit Cooley asks, is IQ atmospheric? What do you think about Dr. Ritchie claiming that his IQ is higher than yours? And this is to do with a recent appearance you made on...
On the Young Turks, yes, I was quite taken aback by that. Not that his insistence that his IQ is higher than mine. We live in a free country. He's free to make any assertion he wishes. But the idea that IQ is affected by the atmosphere, I was very surprised by that. And then he was going to make some sort of crushing argument about the superiority of Black Africans by pointing to who built the pyramids. And I had to explain to him that, well, the pyramids were north of the Sahara. He had promised me a return engagement, a half hour of deep and no doubt stimulating dialogue on the subject of race and IQ. But I think he has chickened out. So Dr. Ritchie, apparently he has a PhD in something from somewhere. But Dr. Ritchie, if you're listening, you're a chicken.
Indeed. Okay, another one from some random bloke. What does Jared think of neoconservatism? Here in Australia, John Howard was a strong neocon, and he was actually the one who opened the floodgates to legal immigrants on increasing GDP. Neoconservatives seem to be as destructive as white liberals.
I think in many ways that's correct. They haven't fallen for the worst sorts of foolishness, but... By drawing the line on what is acceptable, conservatives in general, neo or paleo for that matter, if they are unable to see that race is the important question, then they're just slowing down the dispossession. They are slightly lowering the pace of our ultimate disappearance. If conservatives or neoconservatives, they're talking about taxes or they're talking about the role of government, that's all fine. That's all good. And we can have debates about that once we have our little ethnostate in which white people are working together for a better future. But to fail to understand that the entire texture of a Western European country, a white country, European country, is a function of the people who live there. And all of our institutions, all of our expectations, our way of being, our manners, all of these things are formed from our biology. To fail to recognize that means that everything they claim to care about is going to go away. I like to ask conservatives, American conservatives, if they really do believe in small government, if they believe in, restrictions on abortion, if they really believe in the Second Amendment, if they really believe in no taxation, there is the perfect place for them. It's called the tribal areas in Pakistan. No, practically no government, no taxation. Weapons are everywhere. There, you can't get an abortion no matter how hard you try. That should be their perfect place. And on the other hand, if you ask them, if you were to leave the United States, where would you like to go live? Often they'll say, oh, Denmark looks good, or Sweden. These are socialist countries. What makes Denmark appealing to a conservative, a constitutional, small government, Bible-believing, conservative, Christian? It's the fact that it's full of white people. But this is this obvious connection that they fail to make. And I tell conservatives, everything you claim to love, all of the things that you think you're working for are going to be swept away by non-whites for whom the Constitution, liberty, all of this stuff is just a bunch of abstraction. They're here to make a buck and clear out if they feel like it. They just don't, they refuse to understand that. Except that I think, again, at some level, so many white people do understand it. They just don't dare admit it to themselves, certainly not to others.
Yeah, I would agree. Eunice Locker from Monoculturi FM says, Millennial Woes. Hi there, Woes and Jared. I just came back from Tallinn. The Christmas market was nice and very white. Might go back in February to see Ethno Future 7 after the two-year COVID break. My God, I can't believe it's number 7. I spoke at Ethno Future in Estonia. It's in Tallinn. 2018, I think that was the speech that I gave about Jordan Peterson. I think that was Ethno Future 2 at the time, but I can't remember now. But my God, that's amazing. So, yes, well, that's from Eunice, who you know. And
Eunice, can you be a little more forthcoming?
He's with Monoculturi FM. He's a Finnish broadcaster, and he organized the conference. So,
yes.
Yeah.
No, that was I spoke at one of those conferences as well. Tallinn is a wonderful place. The Baltic republics are just remarkable. And I don't know when I've had a more emotional experience than walking in torchlight parades in both Estonia and Lithuania. It is so uplifting to be marching with these proud, patriotic white people, all singing and talking about their own peoplehood and their own greatness in Estonia, where the tradition is longer and the numbers are larger. I was practically weeping with joy in this celebration of peoplehood. It's such a wonderful experience. It'd be worth going back just to march in that parade.
Yeah, and I have to say that Tallinn is a beautiful city, and the Christmas market. I don't think I saw the Christmas market, but I was there in February of 2018, and it was just wonderful. It was a picture postcard, snow globe kind of thing. It was wonderful. The next one is from Blunderbuss, and he indignantly says, COVID was invented by E. Michael Jones to get out of his debate with Jared.
Well, that's not true. We did debate we did it by video. And in my own modest view, I believe I crushed him beneath the wheels of my chariot, but I'm sure he would have a different opinion.
All right. I do remember the debate, and yes, I would have to agree. But obviously, you're my guest, so I would say that.
yes.
All right. K-Max says, Jared, politically, do we have a reason to fear East Asian people's rise into positions of power? I sense Asians get along well with whites, but will they treat us more fairly than other groups have?
I think if the Chinese ever hold the whip hand, they will not be kind taskmasters. As for Asians here in the United States, it's a funny thing about them. They used to try very hard to assimilate. They were called the model minority. I know much less well about how East Asians get along in other European countries. Now, of course, the Asians that you have in Britain, the South Asians, they're a whole different kettle of fish. But East Asians, Japanese, Chinese, Koreans here in the United States, they have generally been very well behaved. Of course, they don't commit crime at anything like the rates of blacks or Hispanics. Their crime rates are lower than whites. Their illegitimacy rates are lower. Their welfare use is lower. Their incomes per capita and household are higher than whites. So in many respects, you could describe them as objectively more successful than whites. On the other hand, they do not build the kind of society in which we wish to live. They are not us. Now, another strange thing about them is that they are increasingly adopting what one Asian Yale student called luxury beliefs. And by luxury beliefs, he meant this crazy wokeness. Asians have figured out that if you want to be genuinely fashionable and part of the ruling class, there are certain things you have to believe. And one of them is that the races are equivalent, that you could swap out the white population and swap in a bunch of Somalis, and, you know, in a generation two, you know, it'd just be exactly the same place, probably better. And they have to believe these things in order to get ahead, to the point that, astonishingly enough, there have been Asians who have been demonstrating in favor of racial preferences for Hispanics and Blacks and American Indians at college admissions, university admissions, and in employment in big corporations. I didn't think that day would ever come, but they have realized that those who have the power and those who have the prestige think and say certain things. And they are beginning, against their own interests, just as whites are doing, to think and say those very things. Now, if the nation were composed exclusively of Asians and whites, if there are two racial groups that can get along harmoniously, it is probably those two. Of course, that would mean, inevitably, a kind of racial blending and a disappearance of white people. There are infinite reserves of Asians, although they're not less infinite than Africans these days. They're not infinite reserves of whites. But as I said before, if we are to be replaced by anyone, they would be my choice. On the other hand, I absolutely refuse to be replaced, and I will fight that to my last dying breath. But if we have to go down and somebody else takes over, they would be the ones that I would choose.
All right. There's a nice message from Eternal Angler, which I can't remember if I already read it out, but he said, thank you for your service to our race.
It's a privilege and an honor, and I can't think of anything I would rather be doing.
All right. Thin Red Line says, you deserve all the praise, Mr. Taylor, for all your years of service.
That's nice. When do I get my gold watch?
We'll see about arranging that next year, perhaps. Rootin' Tootin' says, happy Christmas. Thank you very much. Pessimistic idealism, and this is outside of your usual wheelhouse, but I'll ask it. Does Mr. Taylor believe in the existence of the soul or in life after death?
Well, this is something I don't discuss. I beg your pardon. I plead the fifth.
Okay.
That's what we do in America, you know.
Yeah, I know. Okay, Wibble. People will demand to protect an animal from an invasive species because they know the native species will eventually be destroyed, yet they will never give a white man that same protection. Well, of course, that's because they don't think that the white race is actually in any danger, because, you know, they've been told that. Sorry, Jared.
I think many of them, they would say the loss, losing the white race would be no loss at all, because it is we who have unleashed all these plagues upon the rest of the world. Racism and colonialism and homophobia and male chauvinism, all of those things they've been taught to believe originated with us, whereas we're the only people who have ever fought those things consistently. So I think many would say, yes, if the white race were to disappear, who cares? There was a moderately successful author in the United States who died recently. Her name was Porter, and I've forgotten her name now. She did something very strange. She tried to cook all of the 524 recipes in the Julia Child cookbook in a single year in a tiny Manhattan apartment with a small kitchen. And she wrote a blog about this, and it was made into a movie. And she became a moderately successful liberal. Well, as it turns out, and she died recently, and she garnered a certain amount of attention and admiration. She had written in her Twitter feed, which is still up. You know, this is an interesting thing. What do you do about the Twitter feeds of dead people? I guess you just write RIP on them and close them to public consumption, or what do you do with them? In any case, hers is still open. And poking through it, you could see that she said, I can understand the argument for just slaughtering white people in the street. And I can understand why people think that we should just be eliminated. We're just so bad. Now, why would a not obviously insane, moderately successful, and just perfectly ordinary white woman say such a thing? This is the kind of poison that we suffer from. And so those who would say, well, we might as well just be bred out of existence, that'd be just fine, I think that would not be an unusual view. I don't know if you're aware of the extent to which in the United States, advertising, it now consists almost exclusively of interracial couples. Often it is a black man and a pretty blonde woman, sometimes a brunette. Occasionally you'll have a white man and a black woman, or an Asian man, there'll be a mix of some kind. I was just going by my local drugstore, and it's advertising, it's urging people to come in and get their vaccine. And blow me, it's a couple, it's a dark African-looking guy with a blonde woman, and each of them has a mulatto child on his lap, and they're all bragging that they got the vaccine and come in and be just like us. This is everywhere in the United States. And so I believe that those people would say that losing white people, that would be no loss whatsoever.
Yeah, I just think that's absolutely tragic.
Oh, I've thought of the woman, Julie Porter was her name, this moderately successful woman who died recently and who thought it would just be perfectly logical to just massacre us all. Excuse me.
Here's an easy question. Northwind asks, Jared, what's your favorite Northern European country?
Gosh, well, you know, you were singing the praises of Tallinn. I think I will sing equally lustily the praises of Vilnius. I visited Lithuania and Estonia. I've never been to Latvia, but I thought those were both marvelous, marvelous places. Perhaps I was more attracted to Lithuania because that's the one I got to first. And I must say, I had to control myself and not just absolutely gape at the gorgeous women just walking down the streets of Vilnius. By the time I got to Tallinn, I was perhaps, I'd made a kind of seasonal adjustment, and I wasn't quite as ill-mannered as I had been in Vilnius. But both those countries, I thought, were absolutely charming. The people were wonderful. The weather might leave something to be desired. I'm out of Africa, after all. You know.
But, well, aren't we all?
I'm more so. I like hot weather. I'm just not one of these rugged creatures of the icy north. No, I thought those were two absolutely delightful countries. Of course, I was invited by racially conscious and aware people to give talks. And so I saw eye to eye with those people. And again, marching in those torchlight parades, the kind of celebration of peoplehood and nationality that would be absolutely unthinkable in the United States, aside from some tiny rural all-white place in Iowa, for example, where they'll have a July 4th parade and it's still all-white, all enthusiastic, everybody knows each other. It's that kind of feeling, but on a national scale, that I found in both Vilnius and Tallinn. It was absolutely wonderful. As I say, I could hardly choke back the tears. I was so moved by this sense of togetherness and mutual love and respect and nationality. It was a wonderful thing.
All right. Arma Lucas asks, Mr. Taylor, there is notoriously an unnecessary and relentless friction between various people who would all consider themselves pro-white. What would you say to this? Should these people prioritize finding common ground for the sake of the big picture? If so, how?
This is part of human nature. I think the problem has many sources. One is that in order to be a dissident, you have to have an unusual and possibly at least mildly grating personality. So when we have stepped out of the mainstream so radically as we have, many of us are likely to have rough edges. And when people with rough edges bump up against each other, those rough edges grate on each other. So I believe that any kind of out of the mainstream movement is going to have personalities that are going to clash. And part of the way we have evolved is to seek honor and to be the center of attention, to be the leader. That is part of how the male mammal operates. And so it is a tremendous act of self-abnegation for many people to try to look for the larger interest, to sacrifice our own personal interests for what is greater. All I can say is that for all of us who are in this together, please try to remember that. Please try to curb your own ambitions. Please try not to take personal offense. Please try not to argue out things that are individual or personal differences in public. I think this is the worst of all things. Our enemies probably find nothing more glorious and joyful than to find racially conscious white people slanging away at each other in public. This is unseemly, it's undignified, and it hurts our race. So don't do it. But again, this is part of human nature, and we have to deal with it.
Yeah, I think those are very wise words, and I hope that everyone takes them to heart. Irish Nationalist Media says, thoughts on voluntary separatism in the United States within the law, like in parts of South Africa, France, or southern Brazil, basically build back up plans for the possibility of collapse within the next few decades by creating our own gated communities with our own infrastructure. What would you say about that?
Well, I think that is a very important thing that we must be doing. They don't even have to be gated communities. Simply to have racially aware white people who have reached a certain critical mass to the point where we can take over the school board, for example, or the point where the mayor and the police chief, these are all people who share our views and share our values. There are beginnings of this in various places around the United States. I won't even name them because they are not trying to attract attention. Any kind of attention would be negative. This is, I think, at this current stage in the development of the United States, this is a necessary step. And sometimes I think when American Renaissance puts me out to pasture, that is what I might devote myself to doing, is trying to be part of a self-consciously white community that tries to build an environment in which families can grow and bring forth the next generation. The whole business of bringing white children into the world today in Western Europe or in North America is a very fraught and risky thing. And without communities of like-minded people, it's very easy for children to be seduced by the prevailing views. Children are conformist, and children are likely to pay more attention to what their friends say or what their teachers say, in some cases, even more than what their parents say. And it is only in a community in which their friends and their teachers and the parents of their friends all have this basic agreement that you can be confident that your children will grow up as they should. And for this, we need community. So it is not just a political matter, but it is also, I believe, a necessity for producing the next generation of racially healthy and racially wide awake children. So yes, that is a hugely important thing. And I'm glad to say that this is the kind of effort that is being undertaken in very encouraging ways in several parts of the United States. We need more, and we need more thoroughgoing efforts. And also in some of these cases, people have managed to suppress those egotistical interests and work together in very gratifying ways.
Excellent. Some random bloke asks, have you ever spoken to Richard Dawkins? He seems to me a narcissist and a coward. I have never heard him touch on race except to ask, what would be the point of asking questions about it? What would you say about Richard Dawkins?
I have never met him. I have not really followed him. I suspect that he probably is a coward about race, as so many intellectuals are. It's surprising to me how many people can be extremely competent, even brilliant in some area, but their minds have been crippled and cramped by swallowing such preposterous dogma about race. I suspect he would be very much such a person.
Yes, indeed. K-Max, one last quick question, Jared. What was your rebuttal to E. Michael Jones on the Flynn effect? Many liberals on race mentioned this study as disproving racial differences. The Flynn effect.
For those of your viewers who are unaware of it, it is something that was discovered by, I've forgotten Flynn's first name now. He is he's a New Zealand scientist. In any case, he and Richard Lynn, it really should be called the Lynn-Flynn effect, but Richard Lynn, who is a British racial scientist and scientist of intelligence, they discovered that over the years, we have had to recalibrate IQ tests because they are always set so that the average is 100. But to keep the average test score at 100 for a European population, we've had to increasingly make the tests more difficult. And this would suggest that at least phenotypic IQ, that is to say, the bodily or physical expression of IQ, is increasing, even though we know that genetically IQ is decreasing, because we know very well that the higher IQ whites are having fewer children than the lower IQ whites. So what accounts for this increase in phenotypic IQ, at least as measured, while genotypical IQ is decreasing? And theories have to do with nutrition, for example, or the fact that we live in a society where there are video games, for example. There are many ways in which our brains are stimulated in different ways from the ways they were stimulated several decades ago. So although I am not fully convinced by any of these explanations, I cannot doubt that despite the fact that genetically we have not changed, or if anything, we are retrogressing, our IQ scores have increased. So the suggestion that people would make is, well, environment can change IQ. Now, environment in extreme forms can change IQ. The point is, the IQs of people of different races have increased essentially in tandem, so that the 15-point gap between the average IQ of whites and American blacks has remained the same, even if both American blacks and whites have to be taking tests that are objectively more difficult to continue getting the scores that can be that should be expected from a properly normed test. So at the same time, one of the arguments in favor that it has to do with nutrition or a kind of more intellectualized, more demanding, numerically and spatially demanding argument is the fact that the Flynn effect has pretty much petered out in advanced countries. It's not going up anymore. So this was a phenomenon that no one expected, and it was a breakthrough to realize that it was happening. But to me, it certainly does not negate the idea that there are inherent racial differences between the races. This controversy will eventually be put to bed, probably by what's called BGI, that is the Beijing Genomics Institute, because the Chinese are working very hard trying to figure out which are the genes that are associated with higher IQ. They will be the ones who will probably discover which are the ones that really matter. They will be doing embryo selection. That's to say, you fertilize a number of embryos from a woman, a number of eggs from a woman, and then you can do genetic testing, find out which are the most high IQ ones, and then implant them, and then in several generations, you've got a population with an average IQ of 115 or maybe 120. The Chinese are absolutely unabashed about wanting to do this. They will be the ones who discover which the genes are, and they will also discover that they are not equally distributed amongst all population groups. This knowledge will be very rigorously suppressed in the white world, but it will come trickling out. At this point, even though we do not know for sure which are the genes, we have a pretty clear inkling, and the evidence is overwhelming that these favorable genes for intelligence are not equally distributed among all human population groups.
Well, and why would they be?
Exactly. Why would they be? There's absolutely no reason. As I often point out, okay, let us assume that Homo sapiens left Africa, 150, 200,000 years ago. That means at that time, everyone from Australian Aborigines to Icelandic blondes had the same ancestor, had the same, we're all descended from the same out of Africa adventurers. Well, clearly there were tremendous environmental influences that resulted in the extraordinary phenotypic differences that we see all across the variety of human beings that walk the face of the earth. And it would have been inconceivable, impossible, unthinkable that the brain not be affected. The idea that we could be very, very different in all sorts of ways, but right up in here, this is the one organ that resisted every evolutionary force. It's preposterous.
Absolutely. Okay, there are just two more comments, not questions. Chalky Milk makes a big donation and says, it's been said that the measure of one's integrity is by the actions they take when no one is looking. I've always thought this as a two-sided coin. The measure of one's character is seen by what they do when everyone is watching. Thank you, Mr. Taylor, for your bravery and dedication to us all. That's a very kind comment.
Well, I appreciate that very much. The fact is, it's invigorating to believe one is doing one's duty. And so I don't believe I deserve anyone's thanks, but I certainly appreciate it. And I'm gratified when people think that what I'm doing has been worthwhile.
Oh, many people do. And then Stephen finally says, it's such a treat to have conversations such as these. Thank you both, Woz and Mr. Taylor. So there we go.
Well, thank you. Woz, right. Mr. Robertson, or however I should be addressing you. You know, I have Robertsons in my family tree. So if we go back far enough, we go back really far enough. We're all descended from that 200,000 year ago out of Africa. But so this brings our conversation to the end, I gather.
Yes. I am running quite behind time, so
we should not cheat any of your subsequent guests. Well, thank you so much. It's always a great pleasure. We should speak more often, not just once a year.
Yes, you're quite right. We should. Well, thank you very much. This has been a pleasure. This has been one that I think everyone was looking forward to. So, I'll be back imminently with Robin Riley. But in the meantime, Jared Taylor, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
A great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
All right. I'll be back very soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.